Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started. Today on the podcast, I'm talking with Grant Faulkner, Executive Director of NaNoWriMo. He talks with me about how writing a novel in a month is a great metaphor for being a productive leader and artist. NaNoWriMo is a 501c3 nonprofit that provides tools, structure, community, and encouragement to help people find their voices, achieve the creative goals, and build new worlds on and off the page. Their claim to fame is in their namesake, National Novel Writing Month, which happens every November. I personally have done NaNoWriMo twice, once for a yet unpublished novel and once for the memoir I'm working on right now. Writing a novel is a lot like any other kind of project where you'll have a crisis of confidence in what you're working on. We all have the shiny new object syndrome when that happens, and Grant gives us some advice on how to handle that along with insights on how to jumpstart your creativity. I interviewed Grant at the 2020 San Francisco Writers Conference at the Hyatt Regency in downtown San Francisco. I'd like to thank them for letting me crash a conference room. They are some great people. You'll hear why during the interview. You might hear some background noise and me fumbling a bit with the microphone, so apologize ahead of time for that. Now, let's get better together. All right, here we are. Grant Faulkner. That's how I say that right? Grant Faulkner?
Faulkner. Grant.
Famous author.
The Faulkner part.
Oh, no, you're a famous author. I mean, you're a famous author to me.
Yeah.
I mean, you're the... So why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're doing? And
yeah. I am most known for being executive director of National Novel Writing Month, known to many as NaNoWriMo, and it is the largest writing event, maybe the largest writing community in the world. Each year, about 500,000 people from around the world sign up to write 50,000 words.
500,000 people.
Yep.
Wow.
200 countries. We've had people write on all 7 continents.
Wow.
Not every year, but we have had people write from Antarctica.
Which Antarctica.
Is impressive.
That is pretty impressive.
Yep. We've had people write during the Iraq War. It's amazing. You know, I think people have a deep need to tell their story, and they will tell their story in the most unlikeliest of places and situations sometimes. And that's what we help people do, is overcome obstacles, ignite them.
Sorry.
There we go.
We dropped it. We're actually at the San Francisco Writers Conference. I had to kind of corral him. So.
Yeah. So we help people ignite their creative potential. We help them get over their creative obstacles. And the writing the 50,000 words a month, really the premise behind that is that a goal and a deadline is a creative midwife. And that too many people say they want to write a novel someday, but someday tends not to happen. You got to do it today, and also do it very intentionally, you know, today, and make creativity a priority. And I think one of the gifts of NaNoWriMo is that when many people become adults, creativity falls lower and lower on their to-do list.
Yeah.
And NaNoWriMo helps them put creativity number one on their list for only a month. you know, but that 1 month, you know, it's, I think it's a very efficient way to write a novel, because then you, at the end of the month, you have 50,000 words, mm-hmm. and you can spend the rest of the year refining it.
Yeah, I mean, I've done it twice. I mean, yeah. that's the reason why we kind of know each other. And yeah. I thought, and the reason why I wanted to talk with you on the podcast is because writing 50,000 words in a month takes a daily commitment.
Yeah.
That is hard to do. I know from hard. Firsthand experience. So what are some of the things that people do, and even you do, and we can kind of split it up, like, you know, what do you do on a daily basis? I know you're also a writer. You've mm-hmm. published a bunch of books. What is it on the daily basis that kind of makes you get towards those goals? Because, I mean, that's an important thing to think about, because 50,000 words in any goal, like anything that's a big thing, is mm-hmm. like, boy, if you just looked at it, and it's like, this is scary.
Scary. Yeah. It's easy to say, write 50,000 words a day, and that's 1,667 words a day.
Yeah.
That takes me about 2 to 3 hours a day.
Wow.
And I think that's the thing. The thing when I see people not succeed at NaNoWriMo, I think they come in cold, meaning that it's not that they haven't planned their novel. It's more that they haven't planned how they're going to fit writing in.
Right.
You know, because two or three hours is a pretty big commitment to do it. And so most people, if you're busy, you have to find a window for that. And so I always tell people to do, like, time management exercises before November.
Okay.
And so to really, like, I call it, like, a time hunt. Mm. So take a week out of your life in September or October if you're planning to do NaNoWriMo. And detail how you use time. And
yeah, just so everyone knows, NaNoWriMo happens in November.
November, you're right. sometimes leave that out. Yeah.
I mean, this is sort of entrepreneurial podcast with, you know, trying to do the bigger, better deal and stuff. So you got to promote. You know, nonprofits sometimes have a problem with that.
Sign up in September and October. Do it in November.
Right.
And in September and October, start thinking about how do you open up 2 to 3 hours a day for 30 days. And so that's like, you know, detailing how much time you spend on social media. There are great apps that track this for you, or you can just keep your own log.
Yeah.
Think about, you know, are you a morning writer? Are you an evening writer? Are you a marathon writer, meaning that you, like, write most of your words on the weekend?
Mm-hmm.
So people take a lot of different approaches to make this work for them. I happen to wake up really early in the morning, and if I didn't wake up early and write for 2 hours, you know, before my kids get up, I would not be able to do it because I'm not an evening writer.
Right.
So I have to prioritize getting up early. And then I also have to find other times to write. So it might be like sacrificing writing on your lunch break, mm-hmm. or not binge watching that Netflix show. You know, like, you have to make something successful, you have to give up something, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of blue-collar work.
Yeah,
I mean,
totally.
It's just sitting down and typing and doing what you got to do. And, I mean, I think that's part of the entrepreneurial thing, too, is there's a lot of daunting things when you're an entrepreneur, like getting the product done, product market fit, you know, making sure people get the word out. And that's an everyday kind of grind.
Definitely.
And it's, how do you make the time to be efficient, and how do you not get distracted? So mm-hmm. what are some of the other kind of exercises, daily kind of what you call time hunts?
Yeah.
That's a pretty good one. I like that.
Yeah, time hunt. I think to know how you use time and to open up windows of time, or to find time confetti. I like this concept time confetti.
Okay.
Yeah, this comes, I forget who this comes from actually, but it's about the small moments in your life. So a lot of times people, they wait until they're retired or they have this beautiful expanse of time to write a novel.
Right.
So we're already writing the novel in November, but sometimes people think they need to have that 2 or 3 hour big chunk of time. But sometimes it's about, like, identifying the small blocks of time. So 15 minutes here and there, you know, writing during your lunch break. Toni Morrison wrote her first novel. She was a single mom with 2 kids. She wrote it in the 15 minutes she had, the only 15 minutes she had before going to bed.
Yeah.
Not her best creative time,
right?
But it was time. And so she built that first novel in 15-minute increments of time.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, you don't wait for your best time to work necessarily.
Right.
Just do it, you know,
and
you will. I mean, I think this is like a law for everything. Trust in building big things through small daily actions.
Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, that's what we're trying to get at here with the pod. Yeah. I mean, I write a lot about entrepreneurship and, you know, just all the aspects of that. And, you know, the entrepreneur ethos, the mm-hmm. book I wrote as well. I didn't do that during NaNoWriMo.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a novel and then the memoir, the first draft of my memoir. But
yeah.
The discipline of being very conscious of finding that time confetti, which I really love that term, because a lot of times people get like, oh, I'm so busy, I'm just crushing it. But then they get distracted off all of the wastes of time. So what are, you know, for your daily, you know, running your nonprofit, I mean, how do you find, what do you do? Because that's a different kind of thing. I mean,
totally different.
Writing can be a very solitary thing. Mm-hmm. I know the platform that you guys have makes it more social, and you can be in your little cabins, and which I've been in a couple times. But just what's the day-to-day, like, making a nonprofit successful?
Yeah. I think when you're talking about, like, and relating it to principles of NaNoWriMo, it's so easy. I find the modern workplace so fascinating, because it's essentially like a battleground of distractions.
Totally.
And I think most of us are going through this. We're trying to figure out, how do you be productive during the day when you're dealing with, like, I mean, my job actually requires me to look at social media platforms, you know.
Yeah.
Have to look at email, have to look at social media platforms, have to look at Slack, you know, and then have to have meetings, have to prepare for meetings, have to schedule meetings.
Yeah.
You know, so and all that then leaves a bunch of work that needs to get done.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, I don't know, I'm constantly challenged by it, but, you know, I think it is like that kind of goal deadline, you know, like
goal deadline.
It doesn't have to be a whole month, but 2 hours on a Wednesday morning, you know, like if I'm going to write, work on our strategic plan, I have to like do that in certain chunks, you know, and I have to look like what is possible within this limited, this scarcity of time that we all deal with. And it's challenging because everything's a choice, you know, and I have big dreams. I can make a big, long list of really wonderful things I want to do for the nonprofit. And I could probably give you a list of 25 things, you know, in the next 10 minutes. And I might only be able to do 5 of those things, you know. And so it's that calibration for me of trying to always figure out what gives us the most impact. What's the most important thing? And unfortunately, on that list, like, there's a bunch of things that I would – that would be super fun and that would just motivate me to no end.
Yep.
But they might not have the biggest impact. They might not do the best for the people we serve or the staff, you know?
Yeah. So are you kind of constantly trying to prioritize that list or
constantly
trying not to be distracted?
Totally. And it's like distracted by big things and small things. You know, when I was talking about, of course, the daily grind is a lot of small things. But the big things, I mean, we could do so many big things with NaNoWriMo, grow in so many different directions. And it is like writing a novel in the sense that if you work on a novel, it takes years and years usually to work on it. And you reach many points during that where you just stop believing the novel. You don't think it's worth anything. You question your original idea. You question yourself as a writer. And your new novel ideas always look better.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
It's the new shiny thing.
The new
shiny
thing.
Entrepreneurs are like that, too.
Yeah. So my whole list of novels that I want to write look way better than the novel I'm writing now.
Right.
But I also know that I will reach that point of that crisis of confidence with those new novels ideas as well. And that really you have to see something through, you know, to the end and commit to it to see what its possibilities are. And so when I look at the 10 things that I would like NaNoWriMo to do, I can't write 10 novels right now.
Right.
I can only write one. And so I really have to pick out that one, maybe 2 or 3 things, depending on what they are, that we focus on. And so it's tough, though, because you also, you know, some of these things you actually just need to try and see what if there's an appetite for it, you know. So I think it's constantly this balancing act of trying some things, sometimes even just for the sake of trying, just keep fresh, but also committing to things and making sure you're seeing things through to the end. And I would say, as with a writer, you know, my biggest challenge as a writer is scarcity of time. And my biggest challenge with NaNoWriMo is scarcity of resources,
right?
You know, which translates into scarcity of time.
Yeah.
And so it's all about navigating scarcity, but trying to do it smartly.
So in your personal life on a daily basis for the writing thing, you mean you get up early and that's your kind of disciplined writing time?
Yeah, that's my disciplined writing time. But, you know, I got a job, I got kids. I've got an elderly mom to take care of. I got to exercise, you know, things like that. So the day gets, if I don't wake up at 4 in the morning, I don't have those 2 hours.
Wow. So you're up at 4 in the morning.
I'm open at 4
in the morning. Yeah, I mean, you're up before Jocko. Jocko's up at 4:30.
Okay. Sometimes I'm 4:30. Sometimes I'm 5, just so people think,
you're getting after it.
Yeah. And sometimes I don't make it, but most of the time I do.
Wow.
But yeah, if I didn't, you know, but I dream of more time, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when I have to shut down the computer at 6, it feels like way too early.
Yeah.
And I turn off my computer at 6, answer personal email from 6 to 6:30, which is usually what I call the business of life, you know, dealing with all those school emails, soccer team emails, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I got to walk the dog, take the kids to school, start the work day, you know, and it's pretty much gone after that. So, So I think like it's, but you know, just riffing on this like kind of like how to use time in the best way. I think like as a writer, it's also, I mean, sometimes we do need a big chunk of time, and so I haven't done a great job of doing that. But I have done a few of what I call like these mini retreats, where I'll go 2 or 3 hours away from my home. I'll rent a hotel, you know, stay there for 3 or 4 days, and it'll be like total power writing. Like I'll do 12 hours of writing in a day and maybe go out and see a movie at night because you need to refresh yourself.
Right.
But the goal would be just to maximize, you know, just really lift the project to another level. So it's like a mini NaNoWriMo.
Yeah. Because, I mean, there's a lot of they do this in the startup world, and boy, it totally escapes me. But it's basically a hackathon.
Yeah. Probably very similar.
Very similar, where it's a whole weekend. They literally no one sleeps, and they build an app or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and even when you guys used to do Night of Writing Dangerously, which was this really cool event where you got to eat and then everyone was writing.
Yeah.
And I've never been at an event where it's like, wow, there's no one talking.
Yeah.
It's quiet and you hear the typing of a typewriter.
It took me a while when I first, my first Night of Writing Dangerously, it took me a while to realize what it was all about.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm like, party, drinks, food, people dressed up.
And everyone's writing. I mean, it's just so fascinating because that sort of model, and you see this not only in writing, but in the entrepreneur world, especially, you know, these hackathon type things really kind of focus the mind. And I think in some cases it's good to get away from that distraction.
Totally. And it's a good way to get a project lift off. For me, I did it for revision, you know, just to and it does. It just jumps, you know, you instead of taking a lot of little steps, you take a big jump, and that feels good sometimes, you know? Yeah. So,
Wow, okay. And so is there any kind of thing that you do on a daily basis with your staff to kind of help them be more productive? And I mean, and their people are different, right? I'm not going to, you know, there's some, you know, people are like, oh, we do these stand-up meetings, or we do sprints, like these sprint things, or, you know, okay, we're going to get this code done in a week.
Yeah. We've done a design, when we started our web redesign project, we did do a design sprint, you know, so it was a one-day sprint with some of our board members leading it. That was good. So we do exercises like that. I have a very one thing I'm lucky about. I have a very creative, imaginative staff, and they're really good at brainstorming and coming up with ideas. And so we do a lot of like, you know, like when we make a fundraising plan for the year, you know, we did a whole staff brainstorming exercise, and we did this exercise that I really like because sometimes people feel like they can't voice their opinions or they have a hard time speaking in public, or some people are louder, and so I forget the name of it, but essentially like everybody puts in their ideas anonymously, and so it actually relieves pressure too, the performance pressure. And so
I think the Dallow guy, that the principles, the author of Principles, his book, he's a very famous hedge fund guy, I think.
Okay.
I don't remember his first name, but he built these tools that his team could vote on ideas anonymously, and they have a board. It's all electronic, and they would like the thing would bubble up for the right one because he was worried about that same thing.
Yeah,
Ray Dalio. He was worried about
groupthink.
Groupthink, or the boss likes that idea. Oh, right. I should probably say I like it too.
Yeah,
when it's that's a stupid idea.
Yeah,
but I can't tell the boss that he's an idiot.
It's fascinating all those things that influence the end product. You know, or even like what I'm talking about. The initial point is just people getting their ideas out and on the table. So all those things. So I love that anonymous. I mean, we actually don't anonymously rate them like that, but that might be good too. Because what we do is we get the ideas and they're all anonymous, and then we all jump in and riff on them with a yes and approach, you know, like an improv actor. If you don't know about improv theater, like the basic principles, you get up on stage and no matter what Jari does, I have to receive it and build on it. I can't say that's stupid or try to go my way. So it's this great kind of collaborative principle, I think, that works with
the yes and
NaNoWriMo writing, but it also works in the workplace too.
I mean anytime you have a creative endeavor, I mean, there's going to be opinions, right?
Yeah.
Everyone has an opinion.
and it's easy to get in the no but mode.
You
know, and so I think like we as a staff try to start very expansively, knowing that we're going to narrow things down later. And that whole, you know, of course, no idea is a bad idea kind of approach too.
Well, I like the yes and as opposed to the yes but.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's it's just a more collaborative, I mean, you know, because... I mean, creativity's hard, business is hard, running a nonprofit's hard. I mean, anytime you got to get money from people for some effort, I mean, who knows what's going to work? I mean, anyone that says that they have like the foolproof plan, I do not.
Well, and sometimes like it's not about.
I don't agree on that.
Sometimes the yes and takes the idea and just takes it a totally different spot too.
Yeah,
totally different place. Yeah. So I think just trusting in that. And it's also just validating Bill's teamwork, too. You put an idea out there, and you hear other people embrace it and try to take it further, you know? I mean, the best atmosphere is when no one knows where the idea originated.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's when it's really working.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, everyone wants credit. Everyone wants love. I mean, it's interesting when I forget the name of the guy you brought up, the hedge fund manager.
Ray Dalio.
Yeah. But it's interesting how, one person in the room can affect the whole ecosystem, the ideas. And so as a leader, sometimes your best, it's tough to do, but being more invisible. Like I know Tom Kelly, I think it's Tom Kelly, one of the Kelly brothers who started IDEO. He always makes sure that he's the last person in the room to speak, you know, because if he's the first, that sets the tempo.
I think Ray Dalio figured that out too, because see, one of his if you read the principles, and it's like part memoir, part like this is what I've learned. He's probably the most successful hedge fund manager on the planet, or one of them, or some metric that he's just like. But he is very like analytical, systematic, and he's building all of these tools to just make better decisions because he knows bias. I mean, he even lays it all out, the bias and people, the group think, and you know, he's
have to read that.
Got I don't know how many billions of dollars under management, and nobody cares if it's a good idea. It just has to make money,
so
his metric is pretty straightforward. It's like, how are we going to make more money?
Yeah,
and not lose it for our customers. And so, it is insightful. I mean, you know, it's not the most literary book, I would say.
Yeah,
and a lot of folks in the entrepreneur world really enjoy it.
Yeah,
but it's. You know, it's a peek into almost the meritocracy of ideas, which is so hard to do because, again, like if you're the boss.
It's super hard, and, you know, super hard in terms of like, just that name, you know, leader, boss, whatever. Mm-hmm. Those give people connotations or prescriptions on how to behave. And so it's really hard to take a more secondary role, you know, or know how to do that and still be the boss kind of thing. And I think this is like a real kind of existential dilemma that most workplaces are dealing with, is that we've created a less authoritarian and hierarchical structure, even though that hierarchical structure still exists in terms of like titles and pay.
I mean, it's ridiculous to think you can get rid of hierarchy.
You can't get rid of hierarchy, but at the same time, we're becoming more collaborative and flat. Yeah. In our expectations and the way we do things.
Yeah.
And so there's a tension there, right?
Yeah.
And so I think the people I talk to, whether they're nonprofit or for-profit, people are really struggling with this, you know? And especially like younger generations coming up, like when I went to school, it was more that hierarchical authoritarian structure, right?
Yeah. Professor
lectured, I took notes, I tried to please the professor. Nowadays kids are taught more in a collaborative structure where they do group projects and whatever. So I think there's a whole different style of doing things. And so partly I think there's a generational tension, but also it's a process tension, you know?
Yeah.
So I have to learn and think about how do I be boss and leader and also support this collaborative, you know, environment.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that collaboration doesn't work, and I'm not saying that, you know, that hierarchies are good.
Right. Or, no, I didn't think you were.
You know, but you make a good point, especially with the next generation coming up. We're the same age, so we had the same kind of experience. But what I've found when it comes to collaboration and, you know, generating good ideas, mm-hmm. Ultimately someone has to make a decision, even as the team makes a decision.
Right.
Someone has to focalize that and ultimately be responsible. Because if no one's responsible, then the blame or the success or whatever gets so diffused that no one's making decisions. Because the problem you run into is, there's so many good ideas, and, you know, we want to pull everyone's, you know, great ideas, and we want to make it all work. But ultimately, someone's got to curate the process to be like, we're going this way. It's not ideal, but it's never ideal, right?
Yeah.
You'll never get anything done if it's so, like, you know, whim on the whim. I mean, that's the reason why, you know, I'm more of a planner than a pantser when it comes to writing. And I know, I'm sure there's people that'll be like, you know, that's the wrong way to go. But it's more a question of, I mean, and it's a major source of tension in the workplace.
I mean, I asked, you know, since tech startups are kind of leading this new work culture in a lot of ways, and there are a lot of products that support that, like Slack and Trello and stuff like that. But I asked somebody who worked at a tech startup recently how they make decisions when they really emphasize this collaborative style, and he basically said, well, it's the person who is willing to go to the last email and write that last long email that no one will reply to. Not a good process.
No.
So I think you need, like what you're saying, Jari, is like you have to identify who's the decision maker or how is this decision getting made. And I recently read this article that was about Eisenhower and Kennedy, but they were dealing with the same thing.
Yeah.
So the Bay of Pigs, I don't know my history that well, but the Bay of Pigs was planned. Eisenhower planned it.
Yep.
And it fell to Kennedy.
Yep.
And Kennedy was a young president and anyway failed.
Yeah.
And so Eisenhower and Kennedy talked afterwards, and Eisenhower, and they didn't really get along.
Nope. It did not.
But Eisenhower asked Kennedy, how did you make this decision? You know, and I forget exactly what Kennedy did, but Eisenhower was like, I think it was kind of this big amorphous brainstorming model. And so Eisenhower was like, you want to get ideas from your staff, but you got to go in there and you got to tell them, this is an idea session. What I'm going to do is I'm going to sit and listen to all your ideas, and then I'm going to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And I think like the point of that article was about clarity, you know. And so when you have a meeting, let people know, is this a brainstorm meeting? And if we're going to make a decision out of this brainstorming, who's making it and when?
Yeah.
And stuff like that, which I think you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, someone's got to be responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And even though all ideas are good, and I truly believe that, sometimes you just got to put a stake in the ground and go. Because if you don't, you're just going to completely second-guess yourself. And, I mean, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, from a historical point of view, I mean, just not – it was, death by a thousand cuts, because no one could coordinate it, and then they didn't want to have this sort of political and, you know, who's really in charge. And once that happens, especially when it comes to life and death, I mean, creative things and companies, like, no one's shooting at us, who cares?
Right.
I mean, you'll fail, but, like, it's not the end of the world.
Right.
But when it comes to life and death, someone's got to be in charge.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, and you want that person that's in charge to be as close to the reality of the world as you can humanly be, because the problems.
Are you guys speakers in here already?
Oh, we're doing a little podcast.
Yeah.
This is what happens when you do it live, folks.
Thank you for the interruption.
Thank you
that was Larissa.
Yeah.
And Jari and I do look a little suspect here.
Yeah, we do. We're in this conference room. There's actually no one around, but we're just sitting
about
there.
About 100 chairs.
100 chairs.
To be filled.
Yeah.
And we could do a session here at the San Francisco Writers Conference. People might just start streaming in.
Hey, you never know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's interesting that writers and entrepreneurs have the same problems. Exactly the same problems.
They do. These are
universal truths.
I do not view them as just. In some ways, I don't like these things get cordoned off in, like, the business section versus the whatever, the book section.
Yeah.
Because I think, it all blends together for me.
Yeah, I mean, Joanna Penn, who we both know, who's just a wonderful, wonderful person and a real source of knowledge on this whole entrepreneur mindset. And, I mean, she's 100% right on. There's no doubt in my mind. It's like, I mean, half the battle is writing the book, the other half is promoting the thing, just
especially
like in a
these
business.
Days.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's so much out there.
Yeah. Authors have to be, they have to do everything, really. They have to, I mean, I call it the creative journey. You know, you write the book, and that's just one part of the creative journey. You know, then it comes to like, and whether you're traditionally published or self-published, you got to think about the cover design. You got to think about your own marketing, what you're capable of. You got to think about whether you're going to hire a publicist. Increasingly, if you're on the traditional publishing side too, a lot of people get published by the big houses. They hire their own publicist because the big houses, they might not give you much time with their publicists, you know.
So, my guess is they won't.
Yeah, they won't. You get a very, no matter what, you get a limited amount of time. Like most people get 2 to 3 months of action with their publicist, and then unless their book is really sold a lot, they will get
unless
nothing.
You're Dan Brown or Stephen King,
exactly.
You know, or J.K. Rowling.
They get a full year-round lifetime publicist.
Those are the unicorns of the book world.
Yeah. Most people are hustling all
hard,
the time. Hustling hard, and if they're not hustling hard, they don't know that they should be.
Yeah.
So that's the author entrepreneurial. And people get really creative about how they sell
What's
their books.
What's this? Please do.
Oh, okay. We
Thank
now
you
have,
so much. We now have a Enter there's, Quietly, Please, Recording in Progress song.
There's generosity and kindness in the world, folks.
Yes.
A volunteer came in to give us a sign that a recording is in process. Unasked for.
And
that's part of marketing. Yeah. Trust people. Trust their goodness.
Yes.
If you put goodness in the world, it will usually be reciprocated.
Yeah. I mean, especially with your team and, you know, giving people the benefit of the doubt. And I mean, especially the creative process is just such a, I mean, you're creating something from nothing. You got to get it. You know, the status quo does not want your thing to exist. They like fight it tooth and nail. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to kind of understand what people do every day to be successful, because in my mind, I always think it's like, it's the daily things that make the success. It's
totally.
Not like, I mean, you get lucky, and that's great, but in order to get lucky, you have to have the opportunity and the skill set to take advantage of the luck, and that's every day I'm doing something, every day, you
what's,
know?
What's the saying, you got to be prepared for luck? Like, when luck happens, you got to be prepared to whatever.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about the everyday stuff, I think I talked a lot about stuff like time management, but when I did a podcast way, way, way back, or a webcast years ago with the author Hugh Howey, who, if you don't know Hugh Howey, he was one of the very early, huge self-publishing success stories. And now he's gone on to sell millions of copies to his book with his books, and he's been picked up by major publishers, all that. But every time I asked him a question, whether it was about writing, marketing, any aspect of it, he would somehow... I just noticed he was always referring to self-confidence, putting yourself out there.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that that's really the key on a daily level.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like you've got to renew your commitment. You've got to somehow have confidence in yourself as a writer and your story.
Yeah.
And that goes to you cannot market something if you're not confident about it. It's really hard to put yourself out there. You cannot write a novel, actually, if you're not confident about it, or you won't write a good novel. And I've talked to writers who are celebrated writers and best-selling writers, and they've told me, I've heard these stories about something they wrote mid-career, you know, that they just weren't into, they weren't confident about, and it didn't go well, you know? So it's just something to think about. Like, I think you have to question whether you're confident, and then if you're not, think about ways to either be confident or move on.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same thing when it comes to, you know, your company and your... what you're trying to do with your product. If you don't believe in what you're doing, it's never going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there is some times where...
People won't follow you either.
People won't follow you. No, they can sense it.
Yeah,
they can sense
it.
And it's a hard slog, because sometimes you actually may not. You may be pretty low. Is it? So when you do kind of hit that low, like a day, a week, or whatever, is there something that you do to kind of like reset to get back that momentum, or is it more like I just gotta, you know, figure out the process, or how does that work for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think of something that there's something beyond the individual project I'm working on. So I can go all in on a novel, and if it never gets published, if no one ever reads it, or if it gets published and people hate it, like, on some ways that doesn't matter, because I'm doing my best and I'm telling the story that I believe in. And so that larger life as a writer and that larger life of being creative is what's important, you know. And that gives me something that's more important than the individual success mm-hmm. of a book. Mm-hmm. And so I think, like, somehow believing in that, I mean, it becomes almost religious, really. I mean, writing and creativity is my religion.
Seems that way. Yeah. It can be. I feel that sometimes, too.
Yeah, I mean, when I don't write in the mornings, I'm crankier during the day. I'm not a good person and not as good as I can be.
Right.
And so creativity and writing helps me be a good person. So I think putting something in this larger sphere of life, because whether you're making a new app or writing a novel, you know, it's the bigger story that really matters. And that's what you've got to, like, think about. How are you being of service to others? How are you being of service to yourself so you can be of service to others? So
what's the bigger why and the bigger plan?
Exactly.
Kind of like trusting the process and, like, okay, I'm on this path.
Yeah.
Like, if this never gets successful, I'm happy that I was on the path.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a very, I don't know, Buddhist kind of philosophy. And a lot of startups, people that write apps and stuff, they can get bent about, like, oh, I want to be the next filling your favorite unicorn.
Exactly. And you can, I think when you do that, you also run the danger of, like, becoming envious of other people's success.
Oh, yeah.
And felt that. Waking up. Yeah, we've all felt it. Or angry or self-disparaging or beat yourself up. All those things, like, take out or diminish your creativity. So all those things, those moments when you're comparing yourself to others, is usually not good for yourself. Sometimes it can be motivation, but I think most of the time it saps your creative energy. And so I think keeping that vision on the higher purpose, and it gets you through too. Like, you got to know that, like, life is long.
Yeah,
you know, so
it is.
You might not hit gold in your 30s, whatever hitting gold means to you.
Right.
Might not in your 40s either. But if you keep doing it, you know,
eventually
you're at least eventually maybe gonna have it happen.
Yeah, I mean, because we were talking before about the probability of, like, a bestseller, which is similar to the probability of a successful startup. I mean, it's actually worse for a bestseller because it's probably, I don't know, 0.1%, if that, because there's a lot more books, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, startups are the same thing. You know, 1% of all startups are unicorns, unicorn being a $1 billion valuation. But, okay, well, what about the other 99%?
Yeah.
That's what most of us are working on. And you know what? Some of them are going to fail. Some of them aren't going to work out. And, you know, it's not because you're not smart enough. It's not because you're not good enough. It's just because you either not at the right place at the right time, or you zigged when you should have zagged. And
yeah,
I mean, I have this challenge all the time, you know, because it's tough, right? Like, because you, especially you live in Silicon Valley, which is where we are. I mean, everyone's crushing it, and I don't know if everyone's really crushing it.
It seems that way.
It seems that way, but the people I talk to, you know, when you're at a cocktail party or kind of, like, put aside or worried and don't know what tomorrow's going to bring, or they can't make payroll, or they're, like, worried they're not going to get investment, and they're just, you know, there's these anxieties. And what I'm trying to do with talking about this is, like, get the internal feelings and the mindset and these kind of little daily things that can really, like, help push you forward. Because, I mean, you know, every day should be a gift. You should, like, really be happy that, man, I have another day.
Yeah.
And that other day, this day I have, what am I going to do with it? And that's why I think focusing on, okay, what am I going to do today?
Yeah.
What are the things that make my day better and the day of the world better? I mean, you know, it's a little woo-woo and kind of big thing, but, you know, you get a little older and you start thinking about it. A
little woo-woo.
A little woo-woo. Like, you start to feel the little woo-woo.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah, and you are, in the end, I think, what makes it meaningful. It's that being of service to others. And as a leader and a manager, it's like walking into the doors, and instead of, like, dwelling on what went wrong yesterday or what you want to have happen and how people have maybe been falling short, think about ways, you know, you can motivate them and be kind to them. And what actually motivates people? I hear all these stories about bosses being assholes. You know, and
most people, they quit their boss.
Right.
They don't quit the company. I mean, every data point shows, I mean, it's some It's like 70%. It's some ridiculous number.
Yeah, and who wants to? Who's motivated? I mean, you can be motivated for an asshole in a very short term, you know.
Yeah.
But you're going to burn out. You're going to want to move on. You're not going to like your job. Yeah. Your morale is going to go down. All those things. So I think just thinking, how are you going to support walking through the door, and how are you going to support those people in the office? You know,
yeah.
How are you going to make it a better day? Because that's going to make it a better product, and it's going to serve your, you know, consumers or community better.
So basically, start every day anew. Like mm-hmm. it's sort of like, we got this day.
Yeah.
Let's use it.
I think that's the definition of resilience, right?
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, a lot of times, I mean, there's a lot of zigs and zags in creativity and companies mm-hmm. and anything, any life, relationships and mm-hmm. kids and life challenges, you know. And maybe like that's a good one. Maybe every day, just every day is a fresh day,
mm-hmm.
and then come at it with, how can I be of service?
Yeah. And we're all going to have those bad days, those bad moments. We can't be perfect, but we can keep trying. And I think people generally reward you for that, you know?
I think so.
I think your staff generally will feel that. Just think about what motivates you. What do you want
yeah.
from a workplace or a boss? you know,
be
I mean...
Be your best boss.
Yeah, be your best boss. Yeah, yeah. So...
Wow.
I think that's one thing that's really interesting. Or interests me ongoing about like workplaces and businesses is how all these human elements, you know,
mm-hmm.
because our workplaces have changed so much. They've, you know, the lines are very blurry between our personal lives and our home lives.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
and our workplaces.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And so, you know, if they're going to be that blurry or absorb each other, you know, like how can we make them more supportive of each other too at the same time, you know? How can we make a workplace kinder?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that must be. Is that easier, you think, at a nonprofit as opposed to a, you know, a tech company or a big company where clearly, like, there's more incentives, money, monetarily.
Yeah.
You know, there's all the perks. I mean, I don't know what kind of perks you guys have at NaNoWriMo.
we do have to think about perks that are non-monetary perks.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so I think we do have to think a lot about what makes this environment a good place to be.
Yeah.
You know, and we can't buy it. We can't go do a fancy staff retreat or
yeah.
a fancy dinner, you know. So it becomes about thinking about what can we do together to do genuinely bond. I don't know if it's easier. I mean, maybe like not having the money makes it better. I don't know.
Hmm.
I mean, I think if you ask my staff, they might say, oh, it'd be nice to have some money sometime, or it'd be nice to have that nice dinner out, you know, all that
yeah.
stuff is also good. But you know, I think, you know, it's interesting to me because I don't know. I go to for-profit workplaces and I'm very impressed. I think people can be very happy there without, you know, just because of the money.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't, I mean, I think the best workplaces is not about the money, right?
Right.
It's like they're there for another reason. So, yeah, I don't have any answers. I think the bar gets, I know the bar is high for nonprofits, you know, in terms of like, the worst thing about nonprofits, I think, is a lot of nonprofits, because they don't have a lot of money, a lot of people, there's this martyr complex. And so
complex.
A lot of people will do a lot of kind of work, kind of saintly work for little money, but it's like it's a real burnout, you know, and that's not necessarily good to martyr
no.
yourself for the cause. And so I think like a lot of nonprofits, they have to, you know, it's better when you don't have the martyr complex, when you're compensated. And if you're not compensated a lot with money, then that you do have this like work environment that's maybe more supportive. I don't know. Yeah, I can't really compare the. Sometimes I don't even like the comparisons between for-profit and non-profit.
I mean, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. Because, I mean, it is different. I mean, even the comparisons between, like, government,
mm-hmm.
private sector, and the non-profit sector.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about, and a lot of people try to make these comparisons, oh, why can't we run government more like a company?
Right.
Well, that's probably never going to work. But
yeah.
it's also, you know, why can't we run a non-profit more like a company? And I think there's a better correlation to that.
Right.
But I do also think that they're unique and distinct things that you have to be as a leader and as someone that's going to run these things. Like, you have to be very conscious of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been at nonprofits and been involved with nonprofits where the martyr complex is just so high.
Yeah.
I mean, you're like, really? Like, people are, I mean, they're for the cause, But then the thing that I also see is that the management of those nonprofits, they get sucked into that too, and so they're not developing their people.
Or they set the tone sometimes.
They set the tone. Mm-hmm. They're not good managers. Mm-hmm. They're like, well, you know, we're not going to pay you what you're worth because you're for the cause.
Right.
When they could, or they've got exactly. some big salary, or they're, you know, in this their own little world. And I think that's really toxic because, you know.
Exactly.
As a leader, I mean, you're nothing if you don't have your people.
Right.
Like, you're just this, you know, someone on some soapbox saying stuff. I mean, you even have no control over what they do. You had no idea what they're doing. You can only say, can you please do this? And you have to tell better stories, and that's why yeah. stories are important. But
this is the challenge. you do not truly know what they're doing.
No, you have no control. And the sooner you realize you have no control,
the
happier you are, and the two, the perspective that you get is like, my whole job is to motivate them with a bigger vision and a bigger story.
Yeah.
And every day I have to figure out how I'm going to show up
right.
and be that better person. Because I'm yeah. the, you know, you're the one that's got to, I mean, you have to persuade and convince someone to do something, and then you walk away. You don't know what they're doing. I mean, you can see their output, and you do a design sprint,
right.
and you see their code, but you don't know if it takes them 5 minutes or 5 hours.
You don't, and you don't know like what they say on their Slack channels
yeah.
or their G-chats. You don't
yeah.
know how something you do can ripple through the whole office place. And
it is yes.
You know, I totally agree with
you. Words matter
you.
When it comes to the leader. What the leader says, it's amazing how much impact that has.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's an art, and I think it's like you never learn it. You're always learning,
yeah.
you know, how to do it, and you're dealing with different people in different situations. But it's also an art of your own self-management, you know. Like,
yeah.
Like when I read interviews with leaders and they give their best tips, I think almost always I hear them say, hire smart people and let them do their thing.
Yep.
You know,
because
if you hire smart, driven people, it's really true. They're going to do their thing. That's just who they are.
Yeah.
No one, if you hire smart, driven people, they don't want to just come in and sit there.
Oh.
You know, so, and
I mean,
and they,
generally, you know, but generally, everyone wants to contribute.
Yeah.
No matter who you are.
Right, exactly.
They just sometimes they need to know what to do.
And
but you're right. The smart, driven ones, yeah, they're easy.
Yeah, they're easy. But you're right. I agree with you. I shouldn't have said just smart-driven people because I think all people are creatives. All people have a creative drive. All people want to contribute. And so, it is about like giving them permission, freedom, empowerment. But like you say too, like setting some parameters and goals.
Yeah, I mean, guardrails.
Yeah,
I mean, the guardrails are. I think there's the only thing that a leader can do in an organization is set the guardrails.
Yeah.
And then also, what's the standard? What's acceptable and what's not acceptable?
Yeah.
And if you let things slide and you do something that is you don't feel is right and you let it slide, that's the new standard.
Yeah.
And it will you will gravitate towards the new standard.
Yeah.
You are the bearer of the standard.
Yeah. That's absolutely right.
And it's a hard job.
I think, it's a hard job. You have to be the bearer of the standard, and you have to – the other part of this advice was just like I think a lot of leaders think they have to always be the smartest person in the room.
Oh, yeah.
And that, I think, can really work against you because, well, one, you're not always the smartest person in the room.
Oh, no.
And your staff really doesn't necessarily want to see you that way. And you can not be the smartest person in the room and like support the ideas coming out of it.
Yeah.
And no one's going to walk out of that meeting saying, "Oh, the leader should have been the smartest person there."
Yeah.
You know?
No. I mean, I think you have to be the one that synthesizes the most information as the leader, as well as you need to figure out what's a good idea and what's a bad idea, and then you need to be humble enough to be like, "I don't know all the answers, but I'll find out."
Exactly.
And people. If you bullshit that,
yeah,
I mean, you see this so many times because it's an ego thing. I mean, when you're the boss, you're
it's
like,
totally
I'm the boss.
Thing.
Someone anointed me the boss, right? And you know, you're the boss for now.
Yeah, yeah. You're the boss because you got hired yesterday
as
the boss.
You never know when you may not be the boss.
Yeah,
and you know, young when I was a younger engineer, I had problems with that. I still do a little bit. But I now realize really getting comfortable in that, in your own skin, and really like how do you, and I really love the, what am I going to do today to make my staff successful?
Mm-hmm.
What is it? What do I have to do? Because that's my job.
Yeah.
Your job's to make them successful.
Suck it up, you know.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Whatever feelings of hurt or whatever it is that might be bothering you, Like, you got to suck it up and get above it and think about how to support those
people.
And
that's a hard thing to do.
It's super hard.
Because we're all human and messy.
We're all human, messy, needy. We all want to be loved.
Oh, 100%.
And that whole thing about it's lonely at the top is absolutely true, and you cannot even know how true that is until you actually do it. You can't know it. And it's interesting. And then what you were saying, it is like a battle of ego, and you kind of have to go through those missteps.
You do.
To kind of understand, like... You know, like not being the smartest person in the room. Like, that takes time to learn, you know. And giving power over to others, you know. That takes, like, it's hard to do sometimes. Like, especially those of us who didn't necessarily grow up in that era or that kind of workplace standard, you know. Yeah. So,
I mean, I think over time it'll find its way. Because, I mean, things go through cycles.
Yeah.
But I do like the fact that, you know, the generation coming up, and just corporate in general, and even nonprofits, I mean, they're trying to find this collaborative where everyone can contribute and feel like they're contributing. Because that's the one thing that the hierarchies and the old school mentality was, is that you never really knew you were contributing. You just, like, got your work product, and then your boss, you know, signed his name on it, and you saw him accelerate, and you didn't necessarily accelerate or get promoted, or you did, but it was never, like, a team, you know, because I'm always...
Right.
I always think, you know, like, recognition should always be team-based. I think bonuses are a waste of time. I don't think they work.
They are too,
generally. I think it's got to be the team succeeds. Because without the team, you're nothing.
Right. Yeah.
You're nothing.
Yeah. I agree. I think things are sorting themselves out into a new kind of work ecosystem, which is a very fascinating thing to be a part of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm generally optimistic about it. I think it has, you know, it's about being inclusive and getting, like, you know, the best ideas from your lowest ranking employees. But it's also about being inclusive on the levels of, like, gender and race too.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
creating,
I mean,
this thing,
yeah.
You know, so we're dealing with all this societally, but it's it takes place in the workplace.
It's a very interesting time because I mean, you know, people are really challenging a lot of what has traditionally been a very rigid society for who people are. And, you know, you may disagree with, you know, whatever pronoun you are and, you know, all the noise around that. But really what I think is important is that, you know, people are people and they express themselves in ways that are unique and authentic to them. And you as another person not only need to respect that, they also need to respect who you are. And in the end, we're all just trying to figure it out because it's a complex thing.
Yeah.
And I think we just got to be kinder to each other when it comes to that. Because, again, I know no one I've ever met on any side of the aisle in any kind of configuration that deep down in their heart is just like, I want to contribute. I want to have, you know, a family or whatever you want to do. And I just want to feel like I'm worth something.
Right.
And I think we're seeing that.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing. And we just have to make sure we continue to push that forward.
Yeah. I'm with you.
All right. Cool. Well, this has been great.
I really
appreciate
it. I love talking about this.
Yeah. It's,
it all relates to novel writing, too.
Yeah.
Everyone has a story. Everyone's story matters. Write your story and also help other people tell their stories, whether it's in the workplace or the world.
Exactly. Go to NaNoWriMo.org.
Yeah.
And if you have a novel in you, you may not know about that yet, but it's a great organization.
Thank you.
I personally support it. I personally love the month of November to see all the novels. And just really appreciate your time. And again, we're at the San Francisco Writers Conference.
Yeah.
People are pouring in to hear. It's still a completely vacant room with all these chairs staring at us. But appreciate your time, Grant. And,
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting thedailymba.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur, and frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyNBA and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest that you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about in this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.